Welcome to the Allowed Podcast. I'm Louise Steinman, curator of the Allowed series, presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Allowed is a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. To learn more about Allowed and learn how you can help the Library Foundation of Los Angeles support the Los Angeles Public Library, please go to our website, www.alloudla.org. The Allowed program you're about to hear was produced in 2009.
My name is Adolfo Guzman Lopez. Thanks, everybody, for joining us. Let me say a couple of words about our panelists here today as I boot up a computer. This is going to be an interactive panel discussion. We're going to see quite a few things here online. And are we seeing some of that? Maybe, Russell, you can get some of that going here. To my left is Victor Clark Alfaro, who founded the Binational Center for Human Rights in Tijuana. And he's a lecturer at San Diego State University. He's been studying human smuggling patterns across the U.S.-Mexico border for about 20 years now. And I first met Victor probably about 20 years ago when I was a student at UCSD. At the time, he was very deep into studying the human rights abuses of the Oaxacan immigrants who had arrived in northern Baja California. And he has also studied the violation of human rights of, now how do you call the sex workers? Is that the term that you use? For the last 15 years, he's been looking at the violence caused by the cartels on the Mexican side of the border. And to his left is Amy Isaacson. She's been the border reporter at San Diego Public Radio Station, KPBS, since 2004. And her feature reports and breaking news stories have also aired on national broadcasts of many kinds. And that's earned her quite a few awards, so I'm very happy that she's here today. Now, Amy and Vicente Calderon, who's next to her, began a project called Border Battle. Vicente Calderon is the editor of TijuanaPress.com, and he's been a television anchor and news reporter for about 20 years now, right, in Tijuana, Los Angeles.
It was five.
and Los Angeles, you were at Channel 22 here in Los Angeles for a number of years. So we're going to talk about what's been going on in Tijuana. We're also going to talk, really focus in on Border Battle. But before that, I want to take you on a little trip, and let me see if I can get this thing going here. So a couple of things I've been having conversations the last year and a half or so about Tijuana with people who come up to Los Angeles from Tijuana. And the last one was about a month ago, and it really stopped me in my tracks because I found that it was similar to the other conversations that I've had, and that's, well, how is Revolucion, which is the main drag in Tijuana, is it as busy as it's always been? How is the Rio zone in Tijuana? The Rio zone is the that was where Tijuana's first major shopping mall was built about 20 years ago. And so I'm just going to give you a quick little primer on Tijuana if you don't know it already. Let's see, can we see it all? Yeah. So over here is the Playas de Tijuana area of Tijuana. Now that's kind of an upper middle class neighborhood in Tijuana. I know some college professors who live over there. There are a whole bunch of brand new developments all up and down here going further south. And those are gated communities in Tijuana. Let's zoom in a little bit more. Now, I grew up partially when I was, from the time I was about 3 to about 7 years old, I grew up right around this part. Now, this is called Colonia Alemán. This stretch right around here, if I'm right around here, there's a cliff that drops about, I don't know, about 300, 400 feet. So my house was on a cliff right here, and you could see, this was back in the mid-70s, you could see the Border Patrol raids all up and down here. So at night, probably about 8 o'clock at night when I'd finish dinner, I'd walk out there, and I could see helicopters with their searchlights rounding people up right here. And, you know, there'd be loudspeakers, you know, saying, no se muevan, alto, alto. And, you know, so there'd be trucks coming up and down here. So that was my entertainment, post-dinner entertainment. This is downtown Tijuana. Probably right around here was a place. Now, this is the Coahuila, right? This is kind of the red light district over here. A little bit east of that was a place that I loved about 20 years ago, the little art gallery called El Nopal, which really was a center point for a lot of the conceptual art, some of the artists that who are now very active in Tijuana. This is the Rio Tijuana zone. There's a river that goes through here. Probably about 25, 30 years ago, this flood came through here and washed away many of the improvised homes that were there. And that allowed developers to build all these, the mall that I was talking to you about. And let's zoom out a little bit so you can, and kind of over to this area. It's kind of an area that I liken to Carson, Wilmington, you know, how you some of the Compton area around the 91 freeway, where you see just endless warehouses and some factories. That's kind of this area up here. This is the Maquiladora zone, one of the Maquiladora zones in Tijuana. So, you know, and interspersed here are all kinds of working class neighborhoods. Some of the kind of upper class neighborhoods are more, I guess, towards the downtown area. And I'm giving you this little tour because the conversations I've had with people who come from Tijuana really paint a very different picture of the city that I grew up in 25, 30 years ago. The Revolucion business district is a shadow of its former self. A young woman I was talking to from Tijuana says that people don't really go out as much as they used to, that the artist scene isn't as vibrant as it used to be. And so that's one of the reasons that that I decided to really try to put this together. And part of me feels like I'm inviting you know, people who are out covering a foreign war and bringing them here to give us, you know, news about what's happening. It's not that bad. But it is pretty bad. Tijuana is changing. And to start off with, Victor Clark Alfaro, how did we get to where we are now in the last 15, 20 years? How did the cartels get to be so violent?
Well, good evening. Thank you for your invitation. Well, first I have to say that it is related to the fall of an authoritarian political party, PRI, that governed our country for 71 years, that until 1989, for the first time in Mexico, we begin to see a more deeply democratic change in society. For the first time in Baja California, we have a governor that belongs to a different political party, to PAN. But in the past, with PRI on power, 71 years on power, this system, this political system, keep under control the business of drugs. It doesn't mean that before 90s we don't have drug activity. In the past we have an intensive drug activity, mainly marijuana to cross to the U.S., heroin to cross to the U.S. In those years it was not a security problem or national security problem, but these people, they were kept under control by the state. The rules were actually, the state was the one who kept under control all these groups. But by the end of the 80s, with new political parties on power, mainly PRI and later PRD, in different states of our country, the rules among the political system begin to change, and also has a direct impact of the control that the state in the past used to have of these groups.
At what point did you start seeing, because the Arellano Felix cartel, that family is not from Tijuana. They're from Sinaloa, right? So at what point did they start to become very visible to the point where you were noticing their activities?
In this precise moment, they arrived to Baja California, to Tijuana in particular, at the beginning of the 80s. And by 1989 that I mentioned, there is a new governor on power that belongs to a different political party. But in those years, the global perspective, different things begin to change. In 1994, Mexico signed a free trade agreement with the U.S. and Canada. Also, in 1993, 1994, new drugs entered to the market, meth in particular, synthetic drugs. And by those years, these groups began to change at the same time that the political system began to change and the rules affect their relation with these structures. And we began to observe an intense activity of the Arellano brothers by the 90s, 1992, 1993. Also, these groups, they took advantage of the free trade agreement because they begin to use the infrastructure of the possibility to, I mean, open doors of merchandise that cross more easily to the U.S. These groups, they took advantage of that situation. And it is by the beginning of the 90s that they organize in a different way than in the past because they enter in process of globalization and transnationalization by the beginning of the 90s and begin to have a different ways to develop themselves as an organization.
Then, though, at what point do they start busting heads with other drug smugglers? Because, you know, they're smuggling the drugs, but then they start killing people. What happened?
Well, other factors happen at the international level. At the same time that this process of reorganization would happen in with different groups, local and regional groups in our country, on the border in the state of Sinaloa and different states of Mexico. At the same time, in South America, in particular in Colombia, there were also very well organized groups that were developed themselves in such a group known now as cartels, meaning that probably they have a more well an international and global organization. And in 1989, U.S. Government cut the routes of cocaine that goes from Colombia to Miami. And the cartels of Colombia, they find new ways to cross cocaine to the U.S. side, and they found these groups in Mexico, and they become partners with them. So with this link with the regional groups in our country and with the free trade agreement and with this process of globalization of these groups, they became very powerful in our country and obviously to defend not only routes and territories, violence became part of their own agenda.
Now, last year was one of the bloodiest years on records in terms of the killings, and we're going to talk a little bit about the documentation of that as part of the border battle. But at what point did you stop yourself and say, wow, this is... Because you grew up in Tijuana. Yes. You went to school there, and when you grew up in Tijuana, it was a very different city than it is now. At what point in the last 10, 15 years did you have to stop yourself and say, wow, this is really getting out of hand. This is something that's yes, transforming the city.
It is already a historical violence. We begin to observe this type of violence by the beginning of the 90s, 1993, 1994, new patterns of violence, different than in the past. These groups were out of the control of the state. They reorganized themselves in a different ways. The fact that by 1993, 1994, the new drugs entered to the market, they opened new markets, not only crossing drugs to the U.S., but they open regional and local markets with meth. Tijuana has nowadays the first place in drug addictions in our country. We have 200,000 drug addicts in a city that has 1.6 million inhabitants. And well, by these years, we begin to observe a new pattern of violence with different ways of killing themselves, very brutal ways. And it is already a historical violence. As you mentioned, last year in our country was crazy because in a single year, more than 6,000 people were killed in Mexico just last year. And only of those 6,000, there were around 6,400. And of those victims, 843 or 46 were killed just in Tijuana in a single year.
Now, you were telling me earlier that there was this phenomenon of the narco juniors. The juniors, these were kind of middle class, upper middle class, Tijuana raised young men who were recruited by the cartels to be to be the foot soldiers. Now, you were telling me that you actually grew up with some of these juniors. I mean, did that give you pause? Did that make you think, wow, this is taking on a scale that I never thought would
not take? With them. Their relatives, their parents are my friends. We belong to the same generation. We went to the same schools. I belong to a middle-class family in Tijuana. And some of them, their sons, not because they have an economic necessity, but because they want to live a different and adventurous life full of probably killing and drugs. But it's not a matter of money. In the case of people from the middle and high-class society, it is because they want to have a different kind of life and a different style. And since the 90s, it is a phenomenon in the border. But it is not only them. It's also the people from poor communities. Look, I want to put you an example. In Tijuana, every day there are around 700 people being deported per day. And of those 700 people being deported per day to Tijuana, 30%, we estimated, belong to Mexicans who come from prisons in the U.S. or Mexicans who belong to gangs in the U.S. side. They are deported to Tijuana. We cannot close doors to these people because they are Mexicans. And when they enter to Tijuana, they don't have any possibility to find a job. They have tattoos, the way they speak. They actually are Americans, culturally speaking, because they came to the U.S. when they were children. But when they are deported to Tijuana, they are becoming, and this is a new phenomenon that is going to develop in a huge dimension all along the border with U.S., because all these people, they are becoming the cheap labor force for the drug cartels. They know the use of arms. Some of them were murderers. They have contacts on the U.S. side. They speak English. They have different ways of communicate among themselves that are unknown for the society of the border and for the police in particular.
Let's talk a little bit about border battle. Amy, Vicente, can you talk a little bit about how this idea came about and how you went about carrying it out?
I think it started with a shootout, as many things are starting in Tijuana these days. But it started with a shootout about a year ago in April. There was a shootout in this area in the eastern Tijuana, and at the end there were 13 people who were dead in the street. There were more bodies scattered around Tijuana. And it happened on a Saturday, right? Saturday, I believe. And we got the news about it on Sunday morning. And I went down to Tijuana to go cover this, just said, there are 13 people dead in the street. This is something that we have to cover. And I came back to KPBS and had to battle to get anything on the air about it. And the thought at that point from various people in the station, and it was a real internal battle at that point. People were saying, this is gang violence. It's gang violence in Tijuana. We don't cover this kind of gang violence in San Diego, so why are we going to cover it in Tijuana? And that began a long discussion and a long internal fight about why do we need to cover Tijuana? What are we covering in Tijuana? And I was making the argument that if you had 13 people dead in a gang killing in San Diego, you would have every national media outlet there trying to cover it and figure out what happened. So fast forward then to September. At the end of September of last year, 2008, is when the first killings in this, what became the 350, I think, in the last few months of last year. And the same conversation, which had never really been resolved, revived itself. And in the midst of this, Vicente and I were going down to cover these deaths. And day after day after day, we realized something different is going on here. And we started having this discussion, jump in whenever you want, about how do we cover these? How do we realized, we started looking at our reporting, and all we were doing, especially on my side in the U.S., what I was doing was obituaries, because I didn't have the time to be able to do solid feature stories and to put this into context as to what was going on, and we didn't really know what the context was at that point.
has a lot to do with the coverage of the San Diego media about what's going on in general, particularly in Mexico. We at TijuanaPress.com provide a lot of the footage for the stories that San Diego airs about what's going on in Tijuana, because most of the reporters from San Diego don't go to Tijuana. They don't cover from the freeway. There's a bridge where you can get a nice shot of the Tijuana border, but they don't go across the border. Amy Isaacson from KPBS, the NPR radio station in San Diego, and Sandra Diebel from the San Diego Union Tribune are the only two reporters who normally or regularly go to cover stuff in Tijuana. Most of the other reporters don't get stuff. AP, Reuters, they get stuff from stringers. Not in my perspective. I know those guys are very working hard people, but not very reliable because they want to sell the story. So we were seeing that most of what they were airing was another day of violence in Tijuana. 8 people were dead. And then another killing in Tijuana. But they see this like, well, that's what Mexicans do. What's new about Tijuana? That was the prejudice. So we began talking about this was a historic moment and the evolution of drug trafficking, not just in Tijuana, but in Mexico in general, in Mexico in general. And that's when we came up with this idea. How can we just explain to them that this is not business as usual?
As you're talking about this, can you demonstrate maybe the Google Maps section of it so that we can see some of that?
We'll try to explain a little bit what we did in the meantime, where we can make this play. Well, we began to, as part of that discussion and taking the advantage of the a program that KPBS has about multimedia, how do you call it?
It was training at the time that this was happening. I had the good fortune to be assigned to this program. There was a very wealthy, generous family in San Diego who donates a lot of money to KPBS. And one of the things that they decided that they wanted to donate to was teaching radio reporters how to do multimedia. So how to do video, how to do reporting for the web. And I was assigned to that project, and they said to me, among all this killing was happening in Tijuana, and they said, just do something to cover it. And so this is part of what we did here.
As you choose some of this, what first caught my attention is, as I was showing the map earlier, I'm very familiar with this area, and then all of a sudden all these kind of Keith Haring-like body outlines come up. And this is only of a two-month period, is that right? Two or three months?
A little bit more than 2 months, so the end of September and the last day of November.
You documented every homicide?
Yeah, from that particular, I think it's the 26th of September. 26th, that was a rush of attacks on police squads. Not any particular, they were not looking for specific police officers. They were just looking for unsuspected or off-guard police officers, and they were shooting at us, at them. And they killed at least 3 of them in less than 24 hours, in about 24 hours. So, and that map, that just showing up of the bodies is just half of it during that period between the 26th of September and the end of November.
Well, let's see. So, why don't you walk us through some of these killings, and maybe we can see some of the video. There's video attached to some of this, right?
Sure. So we started plotting the killings in part as a memorial to these people. Who are they? And we tried to get whatever information we could about them, which at the time was pretty thin. But we wanted to also see if by plotting them, any kind of patterns developed in terms of where people were getting killed, how people were getting killed. And pretty quickly, we were able to see that most of the killings in your walk around Tijuana, the killings previously in previous years had taken place more in the western part of Tijuana. And there was a serious shift to the east of Tijuana, which was where one of the warring lieutenants of the Arellano Felix cartel, although he was working for another cartel at the time, has his stronghold. And we also started plotting this, and we knew it before we set out to do this, but as we started plotting it, we started seeing that there were more, the level of brutality was just getting worse and worse. It wasn't just killing, but it was decapitations, and it was dissolving people in acid. And it was multiple bodies, 12 bodies at one point left next to an elementary school together. And then as if that wasn't enough, there would often be these notes that were called narco messages that were left with the bodies saying, this is what will happen to you if you run with such and such a person, or this happened to me because I spoke when I shouldn't have.
Imagine being able to just kill a number of people and just move them around the city. This is the level of impunity that they were operating with during those days.
Do you recall, for this particular event, what was going through your mind in terms of what information to get, what image to get, you know, what questions to ask the authorities, what you could expect the authorities, the police officers, to tell you? What was going through your mind as you arrived there that night?
They don't tell you anything. They really don't tell you anything. They as much as they even, I mean, they give you the number of bodies, just what you can just see from that scene, what type of bullet casings they were picking up from those scenes. And sometimes they were giving us the names of the victims, but not in general. We would have to talk to our sources and just hear the words on the street. And that's when we realized that this was a fight between a lieutenant who broke apart from the main organization, sensing, in my perspective, sensing that they were getting too weak. Since they were getting weaker every day due to the amount of seizure of guns, of dope, of cash, and the arrest made, he began to flirt, quote-unquote, with the Chapo Guzman, which is the main leader of the Sinaloa cartel. I think this will be the most wanted man in Mexico. If you go to every major city who has a drug trafficking violence problem, you will always find El Chapo Guzman. If you go to Ciudad Juarez, it's the people from El Cartel de Juarez against Chapo Guzman. You go to Tijuana, you got the Arellano Felix against Chapo, and that goes on and on.
Now, there are some bodies on the San Diego side. What do we know about, what information do you have there? It looks like it goes as far north as kind of the North Chula Vista area. If people aren't familiar with Chula Vista, I kind of liken it to the, a little bit to like kind of the Linwood Southgate area. It used to be a very blue collar part of San Diego, kind of aerospace industries, that sort of thing. In the last 20, 25 years, a lot of people, mostly middle class people from Tijuana, have been moving into mostly the east part of Chula Vista, where there are brand new developments. I see there's some bodies. Can you tell us what's on there?
The people that show up on the San Diego side were actually killed before this whole wave of violence began. So those are more historical deaths. But we wanted to show that this does play out on both sides of the border, and it is something that both San Diego and Tijuana need to be worried about. A lot of the points on the U.S. side were similar stories to Tijuana, a couple bodies found in car trunks, neighbors smelled something bad, went outside, and the homicide came, and they realized that there was someone in there, and they later tied it into to Tijuana. And there also, you could see these little house icons, which are properties of suspected drug cartel members that the U.S. Treasury seized their assets or froze their assets. And so these houses were part of their assets, and these are in Chula Vista.
We'll play a little bit of that later. Victor, some of the families that you grew up with, have they been too afraid to live in Tijuana? Have they been moving across the border to San Diego? Tell me about that.
Yes, as a consequence of the violence in Tijuana, there are around 1,000 families, local families, middle and high class families, who have migrated to the U.S. side, not for economical reasons, but because of violence in Tijuana, because their relatives were kidnapped or themselves were kidnapped. They were obligated to migrate to the U.S. side.
What did they tell you about why they're moving?
Because probably their son were kidnapped and murdered later. 2 weeks ago, a good friend of mine, his son was kidnapped, and the kidnappers request $2 million. My friend doesn't have that amount of money. He's not a rich man. He's a doctor, local doctor. And days later, the body of his son was thrown in the streets, decapitated, never found a head. But he called me and told me, Victor, I'm going to cross to the U.S. side, but I'm thinking to ask for asylum. I have been, in many occasions, the expert witness in the U.S. side in different kind of petitions from Mexicans. But this is the second time that I hear a Mexican who, for those reasons, go to the U.S. side and is thinking to ask for an asylum in the U.S. side. I know of a case, but I don't have all the information myself, a woman who asked for an asylum and get the asylum. But my friend already crossed to the U.S. side. He's living in East Lake in Chula Vista, and he's thinking to ask for an asylum. I sent him to a friend of mine who is a lawyer. But there is a new phenomenon, this migration to the U.S. side for security reasons, for the violence that develops in Tijuana.
Are you seeing some of that?
One of the stories that we did for a border battle was actually about asylum, and the number of asylum claims at San Ysidro and Otay Mesa border crossings, which are the main San Diego border crossings from Tijuana, asylum claims had doubled compared to the year before, and this was in 2008. And it was still, I mean, it's a very, very small amount compared to the people who cross the border to move, the 1,000 families that Victor mentioned, or people who cross illegally. I can't remember what the exact number was, but it was new. And also immigration attorneys around town were also saying that they were receiving a record number of calls from people who were asking about asylum or any way that they could come to the U.S., but legally. And they said that that was new, and that the feeling, what they were hearing from people, was that for this select group, in Tijuana, it was so bad that they wanted to figure out how to go to the U.S. permanently, that they didn't see a way for this to get better in Tijuana, and so they were considering anything that they could. And the interesting thing to me was that in terms of asylum, that all the attorneys that I spoke to said that it's nearly impossible for someone who's been kidnapped, even the horrible case of having your son's head and decapitated body dumped in Tijuana, it's impossible to claim asylum because you have to be part of a class of people. And it has to be a limited class, so that if you let one person who's had something happen to them in Tijuana, threat, kidnapping threat, someone in their family even kidnapped, come across, you have to let everyone else come across.
Now, you have something else here about carros blindados, right? About cars that have been outfitted in different ways. Can you show us what you have?
Sure. And this goes hand in hand with what Victor was saying about families moving across to Tijuana, that there's a lot, or San Diego, sorry, that there's a lot of people in San Diego who either lived there previously or have moved across who still have business in Tijuana. And since the killing started, people decided that they needed to protect themselves. And we were looking at a news website, actually, online, and saw an ad at Fuller Ford in Chula Vista, which is on the San Diego side, saying that they would armor your car. And we thought, armor your car in San Diego? What is this? And so we went in the middle of the showroom in Chula Vista. They have this door of this F-150 that's shot with every imaginable caliber of bullet to show that the bullet doesn't go through. And so we found out that they actually send the cars to an armoring factory in Tijuana, and this is the video.
Some of you guys have probably seen this because our friends from CBS News, Eleanor Vega and Bill Whitaker, were able to do a story about this relatively recently.
This is the door to an F-150. We tested our armor by shooting it with a 50 caliber handgun, an AK-47, and an R-15 rifle. And as you can see, it just perforated the exterior layer of the car. And if you look on the other side, it didn't go through.
We've heard of all sorts of stories, people from being kidnapped, being shot at, people getting their fingers cut off, people, you know, in very serious situations, very sad situations, you know, situations that, you know, kind of like, you know, make you think that it can get worse. But unfortunately, it's getting worse and worse. The biggest client is people who live in the U.S. and have a business in Mexico. It's a sense of security for them. It's like driving around in a vault. You get different accessories, like the tax system.
So when the button is pressed, it'll release the cover, and that cover will drop these tags. Imagine a dozen of those spread all along the road. It will definitely blow out the tire of the person following you.
And there's also a pepper spray system, so if somebody gets near you, it'll shoot out pepper spray from four corners of the car, and the people around the car will have to walk away.
This car has electrified door handles. So if somebody tries to open your car while you're inside, they get 220 volts down their arm, not allowing them to open the door. If somebody's chasing you, you can turn on the lights and open traffic. People will start opening up for you, so you don't have to ram them to escape from a serious situation.
Now, is this car a police car?
I believe this is to the owner of this government official, so he's equipped with a lot of additional accessories that he's authorized to have.
A government official here in Tijuana?
Correct. These are called run flats. These run flats go inside the tire, over the rim, so if somebody shoots the tire and it pops, you'll be able still to run on these run flats. You'll be able to run for about 20 miles at 50 miles per hour.
There's on and off seasons, but I mean, right now, there's not an off season. It just seems continuous work, which is good. It could range from 35,000 all the way to 80,000. It's funny because a lot of people compare it to a James Bond car. So, I mean, we can make James Bond's car.
This is a sector of the automotive industry that will not request a bailout from you guys recently.
Now, a couple of years ago, LA Times reporter Giuliovi began the homicide blog to begin documenting homicides that went unnoticed in Los Angeles. And I think what you're doing is taking that concept a step further with a video and with a couple of other elements. Now, in Los Angeles also has a murder, a homicide problem. And that problem is relegated to certain neighborhoods, certain poor neighborhoods. And you could say that there maybe hasn't been a level of a regional outrage here because, you know, those homicides are there. What's been going on in Tijuana? I see those bodies all over the place. What's the level of public outrage, if any?
Go ahead, Joe.
No, the difference between both violence is that in Tijuana, the violence, or in Mexico, risks the government, the comandante of the federal police, the attorney general, I mean the attorney district, the director of the municipal police, different comandantes of state, federal, and local police. The violence risks already those who are supposed to protect society. General was killed recently. I don't remember if in Yucatan or in Quintana Roo, another general who now, there is a strong process of militarization in our country. Another general, as I remember, was close to being killed in Veracruz. I don't remember where. So they don't respect, the rules among the organized crime have changed in recent years. In the past, they were like the mafia italiana. They respect families. They don't kill certain levels of authorities and society, but nowadays they go behind everybody. They don't care if there are children, families, the commandante of the state police, congressmen, senators, they don't care. There's a difference between violence here and there. That in the other side of the border, 3 hours from here, violence goes behind everybody.
Even
reporters.
Well, and I've seen public protests and marches of people in Tijuana dressed in white shirts. I mean, has that made a difference?
I think it has done a little bit of a difference. It has put pressure on the authorities, and that's one of the reasons why the Teo, in my perspective, Teo is this renegade lieutenant from the Arellano Felix organization. He began to get in trouble with the Arellano Felix, in my perspective, because the current leader of the Arellano Felix drug organization, Fernando Sanchez Arellano, a nephew of the infamous brothers, told them, you know what, you need to stop kidnapping and killing people left and right. You have to quiet down a little bit because this is bringing us a lot of presence from the military, more pressure from the federal police, and this is having an impact on the activities of the drug organization. I don't think it has disrupted or affected that seriously the structure of the organized crime groups in Mexico in general, but it's having an impact, and that's one of the reasons he thought, well, these guys are not as strong as they used to be. This new guy looks to me that he's already on the, or has the government on the take, so I just move with him. And it's what's happened is that we saw an overflow of this violence. It was affecting more people, and that's why people was really, really getting more outraged, and was even the ones who were afraid of talk, even there's a lot of people who will not talk to you about drug trafficking. They will whisper, but they will not talk and openly talk about these problems because they are afraid. But that's part of what I think is it's, I think that's a little bit different in Tijuana than in other cities of the country.
Yeah, go ahead. I want to mention that local people, we see there is an invisible and a visible war. The visible war, the ones that Vicente and Amy and a lot of reporters, the reporters that come from all over the world, especially from Europe and the U.S. and Mexico City to cover this war in Tijuana, is a visible war that everybody sees on television and bodies on the streets. But there is another, there is the other invisible war, a war where the authorities are linked, politicians, and the financial system. Those people are the ones who really enjoy the money that comes from drugs. Those that we see, those bodies that we saw are only the cheap labor force hired by these people. These people receive every week $500, $400 per week. They are only the army of these groups in Tijuana. But the other ones, the blue-collar delinquency, they are not visible and hardly documented by the media. Like Vicente and Amy and myself, probably they live or born in Tijuana or are close to Tijuana. You guess who is involved in that activity, a businessman, a politician. Nobody's going to denounce them because it's very difficult to have proof on hand. But among those people, in this moment, there is another word different. But they are the real leaders of those groups. Those names that Vicente mentioned, Fernando Sanchez Arellano, is one of the nephews of this. It's a new generation of drug traffickers, are the visible leaders of these groups. But there is more people behind them that hardly you will know about them, and they will never going to go to jail. And until now, President Calderon hesitated to go behind them, to put these people in jail.
Now, last time I checked, there were about 4 daily newspapers in Tijuana. Is that about right? The three daily newspapers, some radio news stations, 2 television news networks. What have you seen in the reporters who cover this? I imagine each one of those news outlets devotes some sort of time to covering the cartels and the drug violence. What have you seen in the last couple of years? Have reporters stuck with the stories? Have they been intimidated out of reporting the stories? What's been going on?
And do you want to have something very, very interesting in my perspective? Because you get this piece by piece. The reporters don't have the time or the resources to work in a project like this, and I mean, I don't say this as against them, but something that, because it's reality.
I remember being really surprised, actually, when I started reporting there and talking to other reporters, and they had a quota of stories that they had to meet every day. So they had to do 5 or 6 stories. So there was no way that they could be able to have the time to look at something and put it into context.
And also, I think going back to the aspect of some bodies found on the San Diego side, is you get a killing, and you will see that killing in the news, in the 11 o'clock news, but you will not get the background, because the official war will not give you most of the background, and they will not tell you that those guys are maybe or most likely linked to drug trafficking. And we can get that in Tijuana. It's part of the differences between doing reporter work in Mexico and in the U.S. If you work your sources and with a little bit of, wisdom or willingness or savviness, you will be able to get some more or less the truth about what's behind that killing. That's very unusual in the San Diego side.
Now, Victor, you were telling me that you received death threats over the years, that you used to travel with bodyguards. Have reporters received death threats?
That's the first time we see Victor without Ramon, one of his main bodyguards.
A long time.
But yeah.
Have reporters received death threats? Have any been killed?
A couple of them. Actually, Mexico is considered the second most violent country for reporters.
What about in Tijuana in particular?
Yeah, a couple of reporters were killed in the past that belong to a single weekly newspaper, Zeta, because they are committed to publish every week issues about drug trafficking activity. Every week since, I don't know, 10 years, every week, are the only ones in Tijuana. But the rest of the reporters, they don't cover, I mean, they report about violence in Tijuana, but they censorship themselves. They only write a note and that's it. But in the moment you begin to write frequently with names and circumstances in details, then that you put yourself in risk. So what happened with the reports in Tijuana is that they censorship themselves and they decided not to write anymore. There are reporters from the newspaper Frontera, it's a local newspaper. The ones who cover the police activity, they go to the streets when there is a battle among these groups or a violent activity, they go with vest to cover that particular incident.
You wear vests?
No. Those who cover
will not do anything for you.
And in my case, yes, I'm a director of an Office of Human Rights, but you cannot. Human rights are linked to violence and violence that comes from drug trafficking activity. And in 1993, we were so naive because we denounced the relation of the state, the governor, and the brother, and the attorney general with the cartel of the Arellano brothers with a lot of information in a report of human rights that the purpose was to complement with that information 84 cases of victims of torture. And since then, we put ourselves in great risk. And in those years, for 3 years, I used to have 6 bodyguards myself and 2 police patrol, one outside of my home and one outside of my office. Because I thought it was a scandal, because I am a professor and a human rights, I decided to tell the government that I prefer to have only 2, and then later 1, and I still have 1 with me every time I go to the streets.
We're going to go to the audience questions pretty soon here, but the last question I want to ask you all is, I talked to my relatives in Tijuana, and they go about their business every day. Obviously, they know, they read the newspapers and they see the TV news reports. The city is going about its daily business, right? I mean, I want to get your comment on that. And I also want you to comment on what this year holds. I mean, we're almost summertime here, but what does the rest of the year hold? What have we been seeing?
Going to what this year holds first, I'm not optimistic about it. We just did a little story together about the DEA on the U.S. side and the chief of the Tijuana police saying that there had been an agreement between El Teo, who's the unruly lieutenant, and El Ingeniero, the leader of the Arellano Felix cartel. They've now agreed to coexist. And so
there's a truce among them.
And so, I mean, when I heard it, I honestly felt sick. And I thought, all of those bodies, all of those people who died last year in this war between the two, it's for nothing. Because here they are again, talking to each other. The authorities are very much on the sidelines telling us about this, but not really being actors, I don't think, in this. They're just watching this happen. And I think that the authorities can sort of pick off drugs, pick off people to arrest, but it's kind of like using a bucket to bail out from a hurricane in some senses.
And also, it was very interesting for me to see, we went to this conference with the Senator Dianne Feinstein. You guys know her very well. She's the chief of she heads one of these security anti-organized crime committees on the Congress and the U.S. Senate. And I was surprised to hear her saying, I just find out that the hits in this side of the border, drug distribution and organized groups that distribute drugs are operating from inside the U.S. prison. That's news to me, she said. And I say, I mean, this is the people we're supposed to be leading the fight against drug trafficking across the border. I mean, it's amazing. I mean, we have this new border czar, Alan Bersin, who has experience, and he was able to inflict some very important blows to the Arellano Félix drug organization, but he doesn't seem to be doing anything new. I mean, they are ATF, the Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms Agency here, is laughing. They don't say this publicly, but they are laughing about the operations that they are conducting in the border, checking cars, because the only thing that they are provoking is the angry, the
traffic
jams. And they found, like, how many guns do we have? Do we know how many?
When, at the same press conference, Alan Burson, the border czar, was there, and he was. They've started doing these southbound checks. So one of the big elements of the U.S. crackdown, in saying that yes, we're culpable in this drug war as well to Mexico. One of the things that they have started doing is saying we're going to crack down on the amount of guns going south to Mexico, because a large percentage of the guns that end up after these crimes in Mexico are traced back to the U.S. So U.S. has said we're going to crack down on this. And one of the measures that they've taken is searching these cars, as Vicente said, going across the border. And Alan Burson announced that after a few months, I think maybe 2 or 3 months of searching these cars, and there's kind of these sporadic searches that just show up and then they'll go away and come back, border-wide, they had gotten dozens of guns going south.
Victor, you live in Tijuana. Life is obviously not normal, or there's a new normal, right?
Yeah, but probably if you see Tijuana from abroad, probably it's over-dimensioned. I agree with all these people that have been killed, but I think that is over-dimensioned the view of Tijuana abroad. I mean, living in Los Angeles, probably you think that Tijuana is like Iraq, or we're killing each other in every corner. A lot of reporters come to our office, and I remember a couple of weeks ago I received a phone call from Univision from Miami, and they told me they are going to cover a story about drug trafficking, but they are looking for bodyguards to go to Tijuana. I mean, this has been too far, because I received a phone call from Telemundo about 2 weeks ago, and they told me, Victor, can you cross the border? Because we didn't have time to have bodyguards to cross to the border. And this is the second time that I hear reporters that go to Tijuana thinking to have bodyguards. And I think it is this over-dimension of violence that seen from other places probably looks different than what it is in reality.
It's very difficult to explain, because the situation is terrible. Don't get me wrong, the situation is terrible. I'm afraid sometimes. I have a 12-year-old daughter who was born in Tijuana, and she's afraid to be living in Tijuana due to all the information that he gets from the media, or from the kids that talk about the kidnappings and decapitation and all that stuff. But the city is better. Tijuana has been getting better and better in many ways, but we have an overflowing problem of drug trafficking. And for me, the saddest part is that politics has a lot to do with the incapability or the unsuccessful or ineffectiveness of the authorities to really do something. I mean, all those killings, most of them were people somehow involved in the drug trade. 90% of them were running errands for drug traffickers, they were laundering money, they were moving drugs. Most of these people, not that they deserve it, but they put themselves on the trouble, and it shouldn't be ignored. That's why we did this project. But that's reality. If you live your life normally, in general, you will be able to find some progress. But now we are beginning to see taxation on legal businesses in Tijuana. One of the reasons we do this is because we need to mobilize or to pick the brain of the people in both sides of the border that something needs to be done. This is status quo for many people. They see this as this is the status quo, the situation has been for the early 80s. But we need to change this because it's getting out of hand. And we saw all these killings. In November, we have the worst killing a month in terms of killing. They have 300 plus killings. They went down, and February was the best, quote unquote, for the amount of killings. But it's going up again. We began seeing in the last month a higher number of kidnappings, not necessarily for ransom, but for among people who, in the drug trade, that they had some kind of debt that I want my money, as you put it when we were talking before, like in the mafia movies. And also, we've seen an increase of killings, not as with such spectacular conditions, but not in the same amounts of 12 bodies dumped across the elementary school. But we've seen a steady way of trend of people getting killed.
All right, so a couple of the allowed people are going to be taking the microphone. So yeah, let's get some questions in here. Okay. Well, let's talk to this young man in the front.
Hello, my name is Francisco Medina. I've read a lot about the whole drug war, especially like in Miami, the cocaine wars in the 80s that was mentioned, how after that was put in sort of a stop to that, the Colombian cartels had to come in a different sort of methods bringing drugs into the United States. A result of the cocaine in Miami, supposedly a lot of the money built the skyline of Miami, which is pretty appalling. Where is the money going now in Tijuana? How is it relative? Like, how is the money being spent? I know a lot of money's laundered through nightclubs, through high cash flow, like sporting events. Hong Kong Shanghai Bank has a long history of, you know, money laundering, the whole drug cartel. I mean, they were created during the opium wars in China. You know, Barclays Bank. A lot of these banks are in British jurisdiction in the Bahamas, Cayman Islands, and whatnot. But how is the money sort of, what's it building?
Yeah, do you want to address that, Victor?
Well, it's very difficult to follow that and to track how the money goes. It goes to the international financial system. When President Obama announced this program to search cars all along the border, if they are bringing arms and money to our country, the amount of money that comes from drug trafficking activity doesn't come in the truck of the car, goes directly to the financial system. In Tijuana, as far as we know, money goes to real estate, to resorts, but it's difficult to track that money because it moves in different levels of society. They are part of this invisible world of society that is very hard to track and to follow how the money moves in this narco economy in our country.
There are a lot of developments from kind of the along the coast from Tijuana all the way down to Ensenada. You're saying that some of them,
yes,
are financed by
course,
drug money.
No doubt, yes.
Okay.
And
I also think that it's very difficult to trace, but also I think it's going back to drugs. I mean, with this big social base, they are consuming a lot of drugs, and that's there's no hard evidence of that because there's not efforts from the government or even from academics trying to follow the trail of the money. But I see that, I mean, that's one of the reasons why these guys decided to, I mean, some people were getting killed because they were not being paid, because they were running out of funds. I mean, these guys operate on credit. Yeah, and now that's changing also.
Let's take another question from the man in the red jacket.
Hi, thank you very much, by the way, for a dim American. It's really eye-opening to see what's going on south of the border. I had the pleasure of reading Roberto Bolaño's 2666 recently, which I don't know if you know about, but it's about the femicide in essence in Ciudad Juarez. And what I was curious about is how cartel violence is affecting violence towards women in Tijuana, and is there a narco culture that is sort of consuming women who are sort of not reported?
That's your area of expertise.
And also just
violence,
a quick two little questions. I'd heard about a character named Hank or something, the mayor of Tijuana, and I was curious if he's still around and what his effect, and if you could comment on Zeta paramilitary organization in Tijuana. Thanks.
Okay, violence towards women.
I thought Ciudad Juarez and Tijuana have the same population. We are very similar neighbor of the U.S. and maquiladoras, the same number and areas. We don't have that phenomenon of feminicidio in Tijuana. There has been in recent 3 or 4 years more than 100 women being killed in the state, around 150 as far as I remember in Mexicali, in Tijuana, in Tecate. But fortunately, we don't have that phenomenon as in Ciudad Juarez of women being killed, more than 400 in recent years as in Ciudad Juarez. We don't have that phenomenon. It's a particular phenomenon of Ciudad Juarez. There are some women being killed also in Nogales, but not in the amount or with the pattern that develops in Ciudad Juarez. That I have been there with human rights that participating, supporting the relatives or the women. And there are different hypotheses. There are people from drug trafficker groups. There are people from the U.S. side. That there are crazy people from Ciudad Juarez. There are different hypotheses. But the real truth, it is that until now, it is a high levels of impunity because the majority of the cases has not been resolved.
Now, his second point was about, is it Jorge Hank Ron? Is that right? He was the son of a very, very famous Mexican politician who's a longtime fixture in Tijuana, who became the mayor of Tijuana. He was shady in the sense that, the founder of Zeta, this muckraking weekly, carried a picture of his assassinated colleague who he claims was murdered by henchmen of Jorge Hank Ron, right? So where is he now? Where's Hank these days?
He just lost the gubernatorial race in 2007. Mm-hmm. 2007, he was planning to be the governor of the state of Baja California. He was after winning the mayor seat in 2004. So far, he doesn't look like being too much involved in politics. He has been always. He's one of the major forces on the economic side. In Mexico in general, he established himself in Tijuana, has been linked in many cases, in many publications, to drug trade. Nothing has been proved against them. I think the worst that he got was that in Texas, they confiscated one of the banks that his family owns because they were laundering money. But there's all these claims, but he's not been really proved to be tied to an organized crime. But the public perception is that he is. But he's not. I don't think he'll be willing to go back officially on politics in Mexico pretty soon.
In the interest of getting some more questions, and I know you had a third one, but let's get to...
My name is Joseph Sanchez. I'm a probation commissioner for the County of Los Angeles. I oversee 22 juvenile camps. Recently, there's a young man that I'm working with right now that's incarcerated. He's only 15 years of age. And he comes from a family where they literally moved from his section of town to San Diego, and the kid is very much he's very much involved in the Tijuana situation, and so I just wanted to ask you, what do you see happening in the transferring? Because I've been doing a lot of stuff in on Mondays over in Chula Vista also, and but my question is this: is are you seeing any of these English speaking kids that are coming crossing back? Because what's happening right now, the recruiting factor where I'm at right now, the Mexican mafia has always been back in the 80s, you know, when Joe Morgan sent his crew up to Chula Vista, they parked there and crossed, okay, and when they crossed, then they started coming in. So that was, 20-some years ago, and here we are today, right? So now the Sureños now, which are the kids, they're the ones that are embracing it, and all. It's interesting because when that war happened, the killing, the drugs went down that whole week. There was a stop. Okay? So I really commend what you're doing. I appreciate what you're doing because it's finally letting people get their heads out of the sand and find out that, you know what, this thing is very serious. And the tragedy is that I'm getting kids at 12 years of age that are tattooed up and everything, and they're already flashing and verbalizing here in the United States, here in California, right here. They're already calling out. Their uncles are the Zetas. Their deals and all that, and it's something that we got to wake up and smell the coffee on. Thank you so much for doing this.
All right. Well, that sounds more like a comment. So let's get a question.
Up there.
My question is there any, are you gathering any info that there is a crossing back?
Okay. Fair enough.
Crossing back English from...
The English kids that go back to Tijuana...
Victor was referring
and then they come back. Then they come back because I'm getting a lot of those kids right now.
I think it's been always part of the immigration.
Yeah, you mean the people who are being deported to Tijuana? They belong to this group from Norteños, Sureños, M13, Mara Salvatruchas. They are being deported to Tijuana. They are reorganizing themselves. They are linking themselves to the organized crime in Tijuana as a cheap labor force. Some of them will try to cross to the U.S. Even the human smugglers don't want to cross these people because they consider very violent. But some of them cross to the U.S., but the rest stayed in Tijuana, reorganizing in the way they reorganized in the U.S. side. as I mentioned before, it's a new phenomenon that has been developed. It's a new phenomenon for our city. We have never seen such a number of these people, Mexicans of origin in Tijuana. They're organizing in a different ways, but always linked to the organized crime.
Okay, can we get a lady in here? Maybe the woman up front here, and then we'll.
Hi, I'm wondering if each of you could give a few specifics about what needs to change in the U.S. and in Mexico to turn the situation around. If each of you could talk about specifics. And I know some people think that this is simply shifted as a problem from Colombia to Mexico, but are there any lessons to be learned in terms of what worked in Colombia in terms of controlling the situation in Mexico?
Yeah, Victor.
Yes, Mexico is stuck with the production of cocaine in Los Andes, Colombia, Peru, Bolivia, and with the high demand of drugs in the U.S. side, with a big market that has been developed in our country in recent years, mainly meth and heroin, and marijuana, cocaine. This is a global problem. It's not only a problem of Mexico. Fortunately, with President Obama in recent months, with the visit of President Obama to our country and Hillary Clinton, there is a shift in the political discourse. And finally, the U.S. is accepting this, its responsibilities as a country, saying that, yes, we have a high demand of drugs. We need to stop or to diminish this demand in order to reduce the problem on the other side of the border. It's a problem of both countries, and we need to find common solutions.
Amy?
I am in agreement with Victor on the demand side, that there's this multi-billion dollar, they estimate between 18 and 40-some billion dollar market for drugs in the U.S. And I think until that demand is decreased, that it's just too much money sitting there for the drug war for drugs not to cross the border. And I also think that the U.S. with President Clinton, President Obama, Hillary Clinton, Jen Napolitano, everyone is saying the right thing. I think everyone's saying we're involved in this problem, both with demand, with guns, with cash going south. So I think that taking those things seriously and putting actions behind those words and actually putting money in the budget to combat drug demand, to increase prevention, to increase treatment. I remember reading one statistic when we were doing this project that I think it's two-thirds of all the drugs in the U.S. are consumed by hardcore addicts. So if you treat the hardcore addicts, you've then done away with a significant portion of the drug problem in the U.S. And I think another thing that concerns me is the idea that President Calderon of Mexico has talked about combating drug trafficking, not doing away with it, but combating cartels, breaking them up into smaller gangs. And I think that that's looking at Colombia, that's not necessarily a good way to go about it, because those gangs then become more disparate. They're harder to combat. And talking to gang experts in the U.S., that's what the thinking is that once you do that, then you have all these little groups that can then do what they want to and become powerful.
Right?
Exactly. So I think that that's one thing that needs to be looked at as well.
Vicente, your comments on what needs to be changed specifically on this side?
I will think that the approach or the drug problem here, instead of a police, just a police perspective, need to be treated as addicts, and maybe probably that will reduce the amount of the demand here, because as long as they don't close this so lucrative market, there will be people from any state or city in Tijuana or in Mexico, willing to take the risk involved.
Yeah, there's a question up there, woman in black back there.
Hi, I'm Eleanor Vega with CBS News. So just to follow up on what you were saying about Feinstein kind of being surprised about the gangs managing a lot of what's going on from the jails, On Friday, the Obama administration is planning on unveiling a national border strategy to address the drug violence. This is with Holder, this is with Janet Napolitano. It's being done out of Albuquerque, New Mexico. Realistically, I mean, can the U.S. really do anything when they have such a huge border that they have to patrol? And statistics are that, you know, for example, people that are crossing the border, one or two in five are getting across. And the fact also that the cartels are much better armed than our local PDs. I mean, is this really even realistic? And given the fact that, again, this is being unveiled on Friday, can the U.S. really do anything to stem or have the violence bleed over to the U.S. despite the fact that you're already saying that it's already there?
I don't know exactly what they can do, what that will be effective, but I think there's some things that they can start doing. For example, put a little bit of control on there's no reason for somebody to be able to buy a Barrett caliber 50 gun on any gun shop in the U.S. here. I mean, there's this statistic that claims that along the southern border with the U.S., there's more gun sellers permits than gas stations. Who's buying those? I mean, they're going to sell to those guys who are able to spend money on those guns, and they are the ones using those guns. For the ones that are not familiar, Barrett caliber 50 is able to pierce the toughest armoring vehicle, so, and they can kill somebody from a distance of a mile. They can be just right on the mark. So that's one of the things they can do. And they can really try to work more seriously to find out. We have a terrible problem in Mexico of corruption. That's no doubt about it. But it's easier to be crooked in Mexico police sector than to be right, because also there's this, in many ways I see a little bit of the same with immigration. They don't really want to tackle the problem. They want to push it away from the view, but not really taking care of it.
Oh, and I just want to mention that arms not only come from the U.S. side, but also from China and from Russia. Some of them follow the route of the U.S., the Pacific or the Atlantic, but not only arms are coming from the U.S. side. And also, according to the federal government of our country, daily enter to Mexico 2,000 arms every day are entering to Mexico per day. And the large amount of arms that enter to Mexico doesn't enter in big trucks, but are crossed by individuals that going back from one side to the other of the border every day, bringing drugs to our country.
They recognize the 90%. We talk to the ATF, and we check if this 90% of guns coming from the U.S., 90% of the guns that were found in the hands of drug traffickers in Mexico were really coming from the U.S., and they told us that was inaccurate.
90% of the guns that they've traced, that the Mexican government has handed over to the U.S. government to trace, 90% of those are from the U.S.
The man in the white shirt has a question.
Hi, my name's Leon Older, and I have a question about U.S. history. Some people have suggested that we can solve the problem by legalizing drugs in this country, making it a regulated business, and taking the cartels out of the business altogether. And the analogy is to the end of prohibition in this country. And my question about U.S. history is, did the end of prohibition get rid of organized crime in this country?
Well, more pertinent to this panel, though, is isn't there talk in Mexico about legalizing, you know, some sort of possession of marijuana? What's, Victor?
No, there are some sectors of society, in particular intellectuals and academics, who propose the legalization taken in the experience of the 14 years of prohibition in the U.S. side to legalize drugs in Latin America or in Mexico, but are only minority groups. It is not the large segments of society and doesn't have the sympathy of the government, because there is an important factor behind it, the U.S. side. And the U.S. government doesn't want drugs to be legalized.
That's very relevant, I think. That's very relevant. The policies imposed by the U.S. in that sense, as soon as the Mexican society start talking about the possibility of legalizing, they start complaining. The U.S. authorities start complaining. And there's a little bit of change. For example, There's the Partido Social Democrata. Democrata is a new minority political party that is running in a campaign about legalization, at least some of the drugs. But we also have to think that that's a very... I think it's worth to explore that possibility, because also we have to learn to find out where do we draw the line. We have a terrible problem of methamphetamine use in Mexico, for example, particularly in some of the northern parts, more quote-unquote developed cities, and we don't know how to deal with that. I don't see, and we are trying to see if we can get some funding to run this campaign against about information about methamphetamine and the danger, the damage done, because you can find some campaigns against drugs in general, but they don't even give you the differences among those. And the kids are using methamphetamine on an earlier stage, drugs in general, and from an earlier age, because it's the most available drug in many of the areas. And that's each side of the city. That's the thing that you can get.
We're going to take one or two more questions here. This man up front, and then we'll get to you.
Hello, I'm Samuel Dixon. My question has to do with the question of the financial side, because, again, there was a book written in the 1970s called Dope Incorporated, which really traced the financial side going through the banks in particular. Legalization as such is a movement that I've seen that has been funded by people like George Soros, one of the biggest financiers in the world and hedge fund operator. The system right now, which is in pretty bad shape economically, I've heard reports coming out of Vienna that a lot of the drug money is what's propping up our economic system right now, because it's the most liquid portion of it. So to me, what do you actually think about going after the real problem of drying up the money supply in particular? Because it's a lot of nice words talking about legalization, but legalization has an actual societal effect, an overall effect on the thinking of people. So what do you think about actually going after the financiers of this, and particularly going after people like George Soros, who has created a situation where he funds internationally all of these democratic parties for the opening and society and all these other things that they're funding, to the detriment of our young people, like you just said. Young people are destroying their minds, and people are talking about legalization. The question is, can we go after the money funds? What do you think about that?
That is the question.
Going after the money is a great idea, but how do you do it? I mean, as Victor, I don't know enough about George Soros to chime in on that and his links, but in terms of going after the money, that's...
Well, theoretically speaking, theoretically it sounds very good, but in the practice in our country, it is not going to happen.
Yeah. Let's get the man with the jacket over here.
It's that there's no effort for that. I mean, they are not doing it. There's no way to try. Excuse me? I mean, it makes sense. It makes sense to do it, but I mean, reality.
Well, reality, we might all die in a drug war. I mean, that's the reality. But if we say we're going to fight for something, we're going to fight on principle, then we can have a principled fight. But it's like saying you're going to give in before the fight. It doesn't seem like we can win the Civil War, so we shouldn't fight it. Therefore, we still have slavery. It doesn't seem like we should actually say something about torture in the United States because we're doing it anyway. We should fight on principle.
Yeah, let's take the last question.
First of all, again, I want to thank all of you for taking this time and for putting in the work, actually, and for being on the front line, as opposed to the politicians who only kind of dab a little bit and then they go back to their protected atmospheres. You guys are at the front line, so I want to thank you for that, first and foremost. Second, I'm going to honor my Danny Downer nickname. And being realistic, pointing out the high-level problems with the politicians down to the workers who were, or the henchmen, who were the 12 people who were killed on that street, and everyone in between. Do you get a sense of futility sometimes when you report these things and when you realize that only recently that the media has placed more attention to the situation, and the government has finally taken a step, a baby step, do you see something unraveling that can possibly just be out of control from everyone's hands because it has been allowed to get to that point? Do you get a sense that there is nothing that can really be done?
I'm not very optimistic in that sense, but I believe we have to be doing, we have to keep doing something. That this is what we believe we can do from our perspective. Yeah, sometimes I really feel sad, and I have I talked to one of my sources, and I talked to that guy 3 years ago. He knows about it. He's an expert. No, he don't consider himself that because he has been working in very close, and he has very good sources and good people. People that is not very good, but that very well informing what's going on. His perspective was worse today than in 2 years ago when I talk about with him. And that really makes me sad. Doesn't seem winnable. The fact that they reached this truce and that everything is, quote unquote, business as usual, it's terrible. It makes me sad. I mean, Tijuana is a great city. Tijuana has a lot of opportunities. You can. If you don't get in dark alleys, you can go there and still you'll have a good time. And it's in general, there's a lot of people who still goes and come back comfortably. But the situation, we need to do something. That's why we do it.
And but I think it's that really telling these stories is sort of our way of trying to do something about it and helping people understand, know what's going on and helping people try to understand and have the context of what's going on.
Victor, any sense of
thing,
futility?
The last thing we can lose is hope. And until now, society has not played a key role in this part. Why? Because as Vicente and Amy mentioned, many people is afraid. It is true that there has been a couple of rallies in Tijuana, but nothing happened later. But I think that the worst problem, this problem in grows, society has to take a step to have a different kind of strategic as a society, because we cannot stand seeing how already a lost generation in Tijuana of 200,000 drug addicts, young people, is a lost generation. I mean, seeing how they create this uncertainty in society, this image of our city abroad, the decomposition in society, the gangs on the streets killing some occasions journalists and a lot of people, civilians, 25 last year as part of this war, just in Tijuana. So I think that sooner or later, society will take a different role to participate in this hard problem.
Well, I'd like to take this opportunity to thank Victor Clark Alfaro, Amy Isaacson, Vicente Calderon, and encourage you. We didn't even get into the idea. I think it was a subtext here, but the idea of how this all affects L.A. County. I think LAPD Chief William Bratton and the mayor of Los Angeles have both said that the violence that happens in the border doesn't stay there. And, you know, we've talked about that. It does come north. I would highly encourage you to keep talking about this, write about this online, in whatever form you're most comfortable with. And lastly, I'd like to thank everybody at Aloud for making this panel possible, everybody at Society of Professional Journalists, the LA chapter. And thank you all for coming. And my name is Adolfo Guzman Lopez. Thanks.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Annenberg Foundation, City National Bank, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KUSC 91.5 FM and KCET. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.